Most, if not all, relationships can benefit from holding the situation or person in grace. Dr. Stephen G. Post, Director for Medical Humanities and Compassionate Care at the Renaissance School of Medicine, brings this to life into the world of caring for deeply forgetful people. Our understanding can definitely benefit from a dip into the mystical aspect of life. His book is Dignity for Deeply Forgetful People. I'm Robin. Stay tuned for Tributaries. Stephen, there's a book full of reasons why you wrote Dignity for Deeply Forgetful People. Who did you have in mind when you wrote this book?
I had in mind caregivers. I also, though, had in mind the whole attitude that we have as a culture about deeply forgetful people. And there's so much in the title. Dementia is a very negative term in a sense. It can be used that way. Dementia, decline from a former mental state. And it sort of divides them from us. It invites negative metaphors, which you hear around clinics and nursing homes, husk, shell, empty, gone. But deeply forgetful people is more inclusive. You know, it's kind of more of a spectrum image. We're all going to experience different times in our lives, degrees of significant forgetfulness. Most of it is transitory, but not all of it. And so we need to just think about this experience as part of the human condition. The goal of the book is to create space and inclusivity for deeply forgetful people.
Yes.
That really is about it.
Yes. And as you alluded to, as a culture and society, we're stalling out, aren't we? We're sputtering because the engine isn't working. And having a theory about causes or cures for Alzheimer's and dementia and other things as well, and even a place to house those afflicted, is part of that disconnect. And caretakers are certainly overburdened with this by having that as the starting place.
Yeah, you know, I think that we put so much of our hope on a magic bullet. And it's pretty clear that these conditions, these diseases that cause dementia, and there are quite a few of them, Alzheimer's probably causes half of the existing cases of dementia, they're very, very complex, and we don't even quite know how to define them. That makes it difficult for pharmaceutical companies to know what to aim at in terms of developing new drugs. And so we have to get a little bit farther away from that passive hope that they're going to come up with an answer and have an active hope. What can we do to create a culture of acceptance and a culture of practice that is actually aware of the continuing self-identity of deeply forgetful people, that practices the art of communication? There's a lot we can practice in that area, the skills of communication. Don't ask an open-ended question, what would you like for breakfast? Because you'll just put someone on the defensive and they'll get anxious and clam up. But if you say, would you like ham and eggs or post toasties, you're cueing them with your language. There are so many techniques of engaging individuals and making them part of the conversation and not pushing them away.
It sounds very familiar in the sense that these are many of the ways you would be with a child.
Oh, very much so, yeah. So isn't it interesting if you go to a synagogue or a church or any kind of spiritual community, it's okay for a child to be in the back, a toddler who doesn't remember much of anything, and who is easily out of control, you know. But someone who is older and deeply forgetful, well, we don't think they really have that much business being in the building. We're offended by them, typically. And that attitude, you know, is troubling. You know, what is it that we have against these individuals? Well, they're deeply forgetful. They don't have linear rationality, particularly. They're not able to carry out plans and move forward in time with purpose. But they still have what I call in the book symbolic rationality. They can identify with a symbol that was meaningful to them as they journeyed through life. So, you know, I tell a story about a man with a rosary bead who was not able to communicate, but somehow right to the end of his life, he would clutch that bead, and he knew somehow that his identity was linked with that symbolic object. There's been a lot of research on this, and sometimes you have to be open to surprises. With the right stimulation, he would actually speak a few words of a prayer. So that's a reality. I knew a guy in Cleveland named Clint who worked in the steel mills on the west side of the Cuyahoga River. He always dressed country and western. And Clint got very deeply forgetful. Even to the end, he would clutch his cowboy hat, even in the shower. And then we had to, of course, you know, squeeze it out. But he knew that who he was somehow connected with that hat. And this is so common that people still symbolically have this special kind of connection with their narrative. And they can do very creative things. They can be artistic. They can love music. They can respond to deeply learned music. So we do not appreciate all the remaining capacities which these individuals have. And that's really where hope should lie. Active hope is in figuring out how to make space for these individuals and not just put them aside.
Right. And it's not only about, oh, well, they're going to come back to their old self sort of a mentality. And when you were just talking about Clint with his hat, I'm sure that there is some kind of mirroring going on, that it's not only him remembering his connection to his life through that hat, but it feels like it's a way for him to be connected to the person who's caretaking for them, because the less they're understood, it would seem, the more they would have to clutch on to these things.
Very much so. And so this is another thing, too. We have to learn to notice purpose in behaviors that we may think of as completely without purpose.
Right.
So, for example, I tell the story in the book of a guy who would come in every morning, and this was an art class, sort of an art therapy class for people with deep forgetfulness, and some of them quite far along. And he would put that crayon on paper, and it was completely chaotic, but oftentimes, not every day, but oftentimes, he would draw the same line down the middle of the paper. And people would ask him, so what's that line mean? And he wouldn't respond. He really wasn't able to respond terribly much. But then one morning, after a good night's sleep, that question came again, and his response was, well, it's a map so my daughter can find her way to my house. Now, that's kind of shocking, but the point is that there was more intentionality and more purpose in what he was doing than anybody around could even imagine. And it was very surprising when he said that, but apparently, you know, there was something going on. And this is what we have to realize. You know, I was in a nursing home in Chardon, Ohio, having spent 20 years at Case Medical School. There's a nursing home called Heather Hill, and I went into the special care unit for people who were deeply forgetful, read a little bio sketch on a fellow's wall. His name was Jim. So I went and talked with him. The nurse showed me who he was. I took him to a table. I said, Jim, how are your sons? Well, that was a bad use of language, okay? I should have said, how was Jake and how's Zach? And he would have responded. And in fact, he did respond when I started using their names, but he couldn't remember the names of his sons. And so when I just asked him, how are your sons, he got anxious. Hmm. And then after a few minutes, he took a painted white twig, which was, you know, rounded on the edges, and he just put it in my hands. And he smiled effusively. I mean, if a smile could be electric, this place would have been on fire.
Hmm.
And I handed it back to him, and I asked the nurse, what's the story with this twig? And she said, well, when Jim was a boy, he grew up on a farm in northeastern Ohio, and he loved his father very much. And there was a lot of attachment and tenderness. And he'd gone back to that relationship because his father gave him a chore every morning, which was to bring kindling in for the fireplace. So he found a lot of safety and security in going back, and that symbol meant something to him. And then, lo and behold, there was a beat-up old rag doll on the floor. It was one of these puppet dolls that, you know, you give your daughter to put on her hand when she's, you know, 1 year old. And it looked like it had been around for 55 or 60 or 100 years. I don't know. And there wasn't any hair left on it. It was quite beat up. And he just, he ambulated. He picked it up. And very slowly, he walked over to a woman who was in a chair in the corner of this room. And she was crying and whimpering. And he handed it to her. And she stopped crying. And I asked the nurse, what's the story with that puppet doll? And she said, well, it belongs to this woman, Grace. And somehow Jim knew that. So he went over there. He was being empathic and compassionate, even in that circumstance. And you'd never recognize that as a possibility. But he was actually doing a good deed.
Of course. And I'm wondering, where is the most obvious hiding place of the knowledge or recognition or action of human interconnectedness? Is it a fear of the unknown, do you think?
Oh, well, okay. So listen, one of the reasons why people maltreat the deeply forgetful individuals, and in history at times, it's been dramatic. It's because we so emphasize what I call in the book hyper, sorry for this word, it's a neologism, hypercognitive values. We think that you only count because you can lay out plans rationally in a linear way and maybe operationalize them across time. And that allows us to be economically productive, but also it allows us to fit in with these enlightenment ideas of what it means to be fully human. My view on that is that we need to just put it aside. We forget the fact that we are all fragile, we are all vulnerable. In the studies of women who were in their late 90s, 60% of them have discernible, measurable, significant dementia. It may not be caused by Alzheimer's, but basically, if you live long enough, there's a pretty high likelihood that you're going to deal with this. But it's also the case that in everyday life, I mean, I go out in the old parking lot behind this medical school, and sometimes I forget where I park my car. And in fact, one day, about 2 years ago, I was really stressed out. I actually had to ask a student, do you know if I drove to work today? Which was hilarious, you know. And she started laughing. But, you know, we have our moments. And we, you know, what's more important is to recognize our frailty, our vulnerability, our ultimate dependence on one another and interdependence. But our culture is so focused on invulnerability, on toughness, on independence, and we fool ourselves. We say, I don't do nothing for nothing. But the bottom line is we're not that independent. We're very interreliant. And I think what happens with the deeply forgetful is that they require us to own up to the real human condition, to the ultimate reality of being human. Because when you're born into this world, you're totally dependent. You're totally fragile. A lot of times in your life, when you're ill, you will have these experiences. And certainly when you get older, these things can come upon you. So who are we kidding?
Right. Unfortunately, it does become that. And earlier, I brought up about how our culture and society really is sputtering, I think is the word I used. All of society is in this place of recognizing that interconnectedness, and it is becoming more and more a part of our lives and our work. And a big part of what you write about, and thankfully, is about caregivers. Boy, if you're a caregiver, whether you're a hired caregiver or if you're helping a family member, there's a physical stress and you get pushed to your limits on the mental and emotional realm. And where is the starting point in addressing these symptoms?
Yeah. I broke into the world of the deeply forgetful. Well, I had my grandmother, who they didn't use the word Alzheimer's back then. But she had clearly progressive dementia. I used to do assisted oral feeding in the nursing home. And I was amazed at how surprisingly, even though she couldn't converse, she would sometimes remember my name, call me by name, and I could see a light in her eyes that sort of conveyed to me that she still had love in her heart. And so there was a lot that I picked up in that kind of ritualistic experience of, you know, putting applesauce on a spoon. But I'll tell you, the thing about this, when I went to Case Western Medical School in 1988, that's a little time ago, and I was recruited by Joe Foley, a famous neurologist to whom the book is dedicated, and I spent about a day a week just doing respite care for family caregivers, because we had studies which were very compelling, showing that if you just let the caregivers have, say, a half a day off, even three or four hours, just to go out, walk in the park, go shopping, maybe go see a movie, that actually ameliorated the kind of stress and depression that they would experience otherwise. And so they did not have that slightly elevated level of depression that caregivers have on the whole if they just had a little respite. And we had studies about this. And we actually had a big event, a public policy event on Alzheimer's in Washington, D.C. And we took our candles up to the offices of congressmen and senators, and we asked them to do a respite benefit for Alzheimer's caregivers. And the response was, well, we can't do that, because if we did that, even if it would be good and ultimately economical, we can't do that, because if we do it for caregivers of people with Alzheimer's, we have to do it for caregivers in many other categories as well, and that would be too much. So the people put all their money into finding a magic bullet. With Alzheimer's disease, there's been no magic bullet. I mean, there are a couple of medications that make a little bit of a difference early on, but then even that fades. On a scale of 1 to 10, if 10 is a really strong drug like insulin for diabetes, what we have for Alzheimer's is probably a 0.05, not to be unfair, but that's true. And that's why we haven't had any good new drugs for about 20 years. And you can even go back and raise questions about the things we have. But laying that aside, the point is that we need to realize much more firmly than we do that just, respite care, providing some support. Our family members have to spend down into poverty to qualify for benefits. That's no good.
Yes, I agree. And it's all part of that same system. The last 5 years of their lives spend their entire life savings and then some probably. And as you speak about the dollars allocated for curing research, I think it's going to come back down into the community. And the interesting thing is, yes, we can address the nuts and bolts of, yes, we need to bring this person food 3 times a day or whatever that physical care necessitates, and the hours in the day and trying to get a coffee break or a day off for caregivers. These are things that can be researched, but unfortunately, I'm not convinced we can have consciousness or spirituality that can be taught. That's something, as you brought up earlier with imagination, that's something you write about in your book. You talk about 3 cultures of dignity.
Mm-hmm. It's so true. I mean, in Canada, just on your first point here, in Canada, they have Good Samaritan programs in every province. So everybody with dementia gets assisted living support and, as needed, good, solid nursing home support. Now, our system tends to put so much investment in saving everybody from death, as if we don't all die. We do so much. We spend so much of our money in the last 6 months of life. You know, it's understandable because people want to hang on to life, and I don't blame them, but it can be overdone, especially with people who are deeply forgetful. Well, you know, I say in the book that the only appropriate, dignified destiny for them is hospice. They don't need a tube in every orifice, natural and unnatural. We don't need to be continuing, even if they have an underlying diabetes. We don't need to continue the insulin. We don't. If they have cancer, we don't necessarily have to treat them for that, unless it's palliative. They may have a cardiac problem with an elaborate device strapped to their back. Well, you know what? We don't need to continue that. Just let them go naturally in peace. And when they stop eating, you know, there's the story in the first chapter of a wonderful man who just decided to close his mouth and wasn't going to eat anymore or swallow. That's okay, because at a certain point, the GI system just closes down. And you don't have to put a feeding peg in everybody or a tube down their throats.
Yes.
I think we have to just let people go. And older adults, when they're questioned in studies, you know, they're in their 60s, 70s, and so forth. If you ask them, if you were to become, you know, severely forgetful with a disease like Alzheimer's or whatever it might be, Parkinson's, would you want people to keep you alive by using technology and artificial nutrition and hydration? 95% of people say no. And that's a lot of people. 95% of people say no, which is almost like, you know, statistically saying everybody says no. So we need to completely rethink this.
Yes, and the piece that is lost, seemingly, especially as you bring up with your research, is that getting older becomes a spiritual place and not a medical one. And it's not to say you're going to exclusively give up on any medical treatments, but the balance has to be recognized, certainly. And all of this is bringing us to that point. We're talking about this today. You've written this book, and my gosh, it's so beautiful that the Renaissance School of Medicine at Stony Brook University has a Center for Medical Humanities, Compassionate Care, and Bioethics, and you're the director. So what can you tell us as we dwindle down in time here for tributaries? What or where is the beginning of that compassionate care, and what can we share with people to start with, to have a focus of?
Well, you know, things have gotten great, actually. I mean, you know, so many medical students in this school, actually about a third of them, do their scholarly concentration work over their 4 years on compassionate care and communication. They know how important this is. And it's hard for a medical student these days to get into a good residency if they can't talk intelligently about how to communicate with the whole self, not just the disease, the biology, the illness, but to really connect with patients in a way that is caring and uplifting and meaningful. And it's good for the patients, but it's also good for them. All our studies show that when physicians can stay connected, they find life meaningful. But if they're just doing the routinized stuff and, you know, treating the slab on the table, they themselves are tending to burn out. So we all know that this is the future, and we'll look back on medicine in I think, 5-10 years, and just wonder, you know, why was it that we didn't do more? We have very active programs to teach these techniques and these connections. And you can teach compassion. We have ways of doing it sociologically, psychologically. We use mindfulness and meditation. We use simulated experiences. We give patients feedback a lot. We evaluate people on their empathic connection with patients and with one another. So we make, if you want to call it kindness, really the centerpiece of healing.
Yes, it doesn't get better than that. And are there many places where caregivers can go for support? And I'm talking about family members as well as the active caregiver who chose that profession.
Yeah, well, the family members can, you know, I think voluntary associations like the Alzheimer's Association matter a lot. There are other organizations like Caring Kind, which are national now, and emphasize a little bit less the elusive goal of pharmacological miracles and magic bullets, and really do tend to do more with the possibilities for relationality, for noticing, for recognizing, for knowing how to connect. And by the way, in one of the key things of the book is that you can never say that a person is absent, gone, that they're empty. They're always there underneath the breakdown in communication. And I define hope as being open to surprises, because 95% of caregivers will say, you know what? I was totally surprised, totally shocked, but guess what? You know, Grandma, I was singing a little hymn that she identified with years ago, and she chimed in for a verse. So in other words, you know, we need to do the things that connect them and us. And by the way, there's a lot there in the book on dementia dogs, which is a big movement in Europe and Australia. You know, the nice trained dogs, like, you know, the medium-sized Labradors. That is so valuable. And this is where we need to work more creatively.
Thank you, Stephen Post, author of Dignity for Deeply Forgetful People. For anything tributaries related, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasts are in the usual spots, and if you have trouble finding us, please let us know. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.